think it was up to paragraph 17. In respect of the first concern, I submit that the proposition that the proposed zone goes well beyond what has been contended as a misunderstanding of what is proposed. Yes.
One sentence, we'll make rapid progress on this, right? Can I suggest to you that, and this goes to a point that Mr. Page was making, that the the concern reflected the way in which the submission was originally pitched, and your response is only accurate if we take the extent to which it's been refined as a given, and you've carefully said that it's not the position because you're not resiling from the position as originally pitched in the submission.
Yeah, no, you're right. The configuration of the residential activity area and the restrictions on, for example, the farm homestead area have tightened up. Firstly in the evidence and sheet version, but then again in the supplementary version of the provisions. Mr. Ferguson's evidence in chief carefully analyses those aspects of the zone which are beyond the level of development provided for in the consent with respect to each activity area of the zone. These are limited to the, acknowledging what I just said, the 8 additional home sites proposed in the R activity area, a small amendment to the golf activity area boundary, limited development in the farm homestead activity area in a restricted discretionary framework, and the campground activity area also in a restricted discretionary framework. The evidence supporting the ability for the zone to manage any adverse effects arising from the development in each of these areas has been carefully considered by the submitter's experts and is further analysed below. In respect of the extended geographic area referred to by council's witnesses, this was an intentional aspect of the submitter's relief in order to provide for activities on the Glenview Station land which are complementary of the park and spade development already consented, such as the FH and C areas, as well as to ensure an overall holistic management approach to enhancement of the station's natural values. It is submitted that the size of the proposed zone should not be primarily of concern, but rather how activities provided for within that zone are suitably managed. In any event, the question of geographic extent has been further considered by the submitter and is analysed under the alternative options heading set out below, or further on. In respect of the concern regarding reflection of the consent in the zone rule framework, the intent of the submitter has been to reflect all critical aspects of the consent in the zone. However, in terms of the complex consent conditions, it has been a very deliberate objective of the submitter to refine those conditions where possible and appropriate. Where conditions provided in the Environment Court decision have in fact eventuated as having little utility or practicality on the ground, those conditions have not been implemented through the proposed zone framework. And where this has occurred, such a change has been justified in expert evidence. And for example, we'll ask Ms. Pfluger to expand on the utility of the staging implementation of the consent in terms of landscape effects. So I just noted I don't actually have a footnote for that reference.
Yes, and I couldn't find that.
No, it's,
because I went looking in her supplementary evidence.
Yes. No, that was an omission, so Ms. Pfluger is prepared to address you on that. We discussed it this morning.
I think she'll need to.
An explanation of the future intent of development under the zone and the overlap of covenant areas and the zone activity areas. The evidence of Mr. Ferguson summarises the substantial progress made already in respect of implementing the park and spade consent to this paragraph 4.9. This substantial list provided evidence of the complex nature of the consents and the significant cost and effort which have been put into the process so far to give effect to the consents. Importantly, the first matter listed in Mr. Ferguson's summary includes the carrying out of the initial subdivision that we talked about before and the registering of the covenant, open space covenants.
While I have that in mind, as Brenda asked, we need a new exhibit number for the additional document. What are we up to?
29.
Yep.
that in covenant?
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Ferguson also details the variations to consent that have been needed to date to make implementation more practical and amend important matters of detail. These variations demonstrate that when a finer-grained analysis is applied, it results in more appropriate outcomes. The submitter seeks this zone in part to ensure future variations are processed efficiently or to minimise or avoid the need for more variations of the original consent by providing a consenting pathway for new consents. Such applications can then be evaluated within a site-specific fit-for-purpose planning framework. Mr. Ferguson's evidence appends the relevant consents and their conditions. And for the assistance of the Commission to better understand the relationship between these registered instruments and the proposed zone, I list in my Appendix 2 the titles and provide copies of a consent notice, which is appended to my legal submissions, and the covenant, which you referred to as Exhibit 29, that is lodged over the titles. And a visual representation of the different covenant areas and a summary of their terms is provided in Appendix 2 to the supplementary evidence of Mr. Ferguson. And it's that colourful
A, the big one. I observe, I find that very helpful. Thank you.
Good. Only the most relevant registered instruments have been included in my Appendix 2, which exemplify the registration of the conditions directly from the Parkins Bay decision. Consent Notice 9486490.2.
We'll take the numbers as well.
It's largely replicated in the land covenant, detailing covenanted restrictions on the zone land which reflect those consent conditions. And I think it's condition 41 in the consent that they all harken back to. The submitter is aware that in the future, development is to be progressed by way of consent under the zone in a way that is contrary to the covenants, which I have to flag as unlikely because we've tried to be consistent with the covenants. Then there may be a separate process required to vary, amend or remove the underlying encumbrances on the title where those conflict with the development being sought. That process, be it a discretionary application to vary the consent notice under the Act, or the private process to amend the registered covenants, in my submission is not directly relevant to your decisions in this hearing.
Calling a spade a spade, if we decided that the zone provisions you sought were an appropriate resource management response for the situation up there, you might have quite a good argument that the council's refusal to consent to varying the covenant was unreasonable.
That's right. That's exactly right. That clause is well crafted because it would be unreasonable withholding of permission in that context.
Obviously, I can't commit the council to so whether it's of the same view.
Yeah. What is relevant in my submission is to understand a potential way forward for the landowners to realise the development opportunities within the zone if implemented. It is submitted that given the consent is presently being implemented, but will not be fully given effect to until implementation conditions are completed, as opposed to the continuing conditions, then the likely, but possibly not only, future way forward will be for the landowner to apply for requisite consents under the zone framework, while also seeking contemporaneous variation or surrender of the existing consents. To otherwise surrender the existing consent while it has been partially given effect to before new consent is sought would leave any development activities already undertaken on the land as unauthorised.
Question, are you already past the lapse point given the biosecurity case, given the amount of work that's already been done?
Well, I haven't specifically turned my mind to that. I must be getting close, and that's not a very helpful answer. If that is relevant to you, we can gather together more information because you would need more detail, I think, on exactly what stages of the consent have been complied with, the implementation conditions. There's obviously, just in terms of the registration of the covenants and planting, you could definitely say, lapse and giving effect to a quite different concept. Definitely they've made substantial progress towards getting effect to it, there's no doubt about that. So if they've still got another 5 years, I think, before it lapses in any event. So it's probably not, maybe that's not that helpful.
I don't think it's critical, but no. Like my impression, like one of the issues about fire security was that it creates a large grey area that people don't know where they stand.
Yeah, yeah.
And, but it, as you say, there must be an argument that you're not over the lapse hurdle, then you're close.
Yes, yeah. And the other thing, you know, is that substantial progress part of the test is no longer a test. It's just a relevant matter that the council has to take into account. But, I mean, there might be, you know, if you, with the other witnesses who can give you more detail about what's happened on the ground, if that gives you assistance to understanding how far through the implementation conditions, the incentives, by all means, you could explore that.
Well, we saw what's happened on the ground. It's nothing like a bulldozer to demonstrate action.
Action. 22,000 trees. Yeah. Plants, sorry. The above examples that I gave, which were purely hypothetical, are only of relevance insofar as to give the Commission context and assurance that the zone is not a mechanism by which conditions of the existing consents and train can be obviated. The zone framework is intentionally set up to require the majority of activities in the zone to apply for consent, albeit such consent is generally of a lesser activity status than under the current rural zone and would be assessed against a more specific set of objectives and policies. Alternative options of refining the extent of the zone. The submitter has considered the comments made in Mr. Barr's and Dr. Reed's evidence with respect to the recommendation that the PEP rural zone would be a better zone for the management of that rural resource land to achieve the strategic objectives of the proposed plan. As stated in Mr. Ferguson's supplementary evidence, the intent and design behind the zone originally was to provide an integrated package for landscape management which reflected the cadastral boundary of the Glendu Station land and reflected all protective and enhancement aspects of the Environment Court's decision. The submitter has, however, taken on board the Council's experts' comments and considered alternative ways to achieve the intended zone outcomes. As a result, an alternative option has been developed to reduce the boundary of the zone by reducing Activity Area OSF to correspond with the back of the Covenant Protection Areas CH, I and J and around Lot 9. So a structured plan illustrating this alternative zone boundary is included within Appendix 3 of Mr. Ferguson's supplementary evidence. So you've got that handy, and do you understand where the alternative zone boundary is being proposed?
I do, but it's my colleagues. Well, I think I do. Well, it's fatal, but I'm too confident.
So in Mr. Ferguson's Appendix 3, we've got a version of the structure plan that looks like that, which is not on the wall. But the thick black line follows the back of the brown and the green covenant areas, if you like, to keep it really simple.
Question for you. Is the thick black line in the wrong place since it carves off half of the camp?
No, that's a road, that other black line in the middle. I got confused as well when I saw that at first.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you can also see, I'll walk up here. So I think what you're looking at, Mr. Chair, is that line there?
Correct.
Yeah, that's a road. The zone boundary in both iterations is this line here. Yeah. So, summarised in Mr. Ferguson's supplementary, he considers that on balance, refining the zone boundary and including those areas previously in the zone but outside of the Covenant Protection Area overlay would better meet the objectives of the district planning. So, as part of the reduced zone boundary, there's also an additional reference to the Glenview Station Zone Open Space Protection Overlay, which would be in the rural zone, back out in the rural zone again. So that the zone provisions still reference the wider open space protections in the top half, if you like, of the station. So Mr. Ferguson will be able to take you through how that would work mechanically. And it's possibly related to your earlier question, Mr. Chair, about whether or not this could be a subzone or an overlay within the rural zone that borrows from that concept as well. Partial or full rezoning of the station is proposed by the Glenview Bay trustees. My submission will better provide for the integrated management of the protection and enhancement of natural character, landscape, biodiversity, recreation values, along with the sustainable economic use of the land than the rural zone. And then I just move on to some key issues. If you're finished with that.
Yes. Good to go.
Cool. On traffic, Ms. Banks for the council holds concern that with the increase in traffic from activities that have not been assessed by Mr. Carr at this stage, to give some assurance that the impacts on the road network will be minimal. And Mr. Barr also makes the following assessment set out here in his rebuttal. Firstly, notably, in response, 17 of the 33 district plan chapters notified do not mention traffic in the section 32 report at all, evidencing that the level of detail required by QLDC for district plan submissions far outweighs the traffic analysis that has been undertaken by QLDC for its own zone change proposals. And this includes substantial zones being densified under the district plan, such as the low density residential zone, which will double the density in some instances, but only provides one passing comment on the effects of increased traffic in that low-density zone. The expansion of areas to be upzoned similarly lacks a rigorous assessment, such as the rural lifestyle zone expansions. But that discrepancy aside, Mr. Carr's summary statement provides further assessment of the likely scale of traffic generation that will subsequently be assessed in the restricted discretionary framework for key elements, and concludes that traffic safety will not be compromised by the scale of development contemplated in the zone. On the open space farm activity area, whether the boundary of the zone encompasses the full station as originally submitted or the reduced option in combination with the open space protection overlay, the proposed package provides a superior planning framework to the rural zone for the site. The zone provisions are intended to achieve the same or better outcomes than consent in terms of protection and, more importantly, enhancement of the landscape, natural character, biodiversity and recreation values of the land. And as an integrated package, the proposed zone ensures the land will be managed coherently in the long term, which is not otherwise provided for in the rural zone. Within the OSF and GSOSF, the provisions are intended to be consistent with the underlying covenants. Two dwellings are anticipated within the covenanted area as restricted discretionary activities, as provided for under the existing consent. On the lakeshore activity area, no material issues have been raised with respect to the lakeshore activity area. The LS provides for the same nature and scale of development authorised by the consent, being visitor accommodation, the golf course clubhouse, public access trails and the public jetty. The location of built development and surrounding curtilage has been amended and improved based on further site investigations, leading to the difference between the boundary of the covenant compared to the proposed activity area. And finally, on the residential activity area, and finally, firstly on height. Dr. Reed's concerns regarding the additional 8 home sites in the R activity area appear to relate to primarily over-domestication from this additional development combined with potential increased visibility due to height increases or perceived height increases and potentially varied designs. Ms. Pfluger assesses the effects of both the additional 8 sites as well as the controls over height and variation of design in her evidence in chief and supplementary statement. Based upon clarification from Mr. Ferguson as to the actual increase in height being only 0.2 metres, Ms. Pfluger considers that would be visually barely discernible when viewed from public viewpoints, such that adverse effects would be avoided. I submit that Dr. Reed's commentary.
Well, I wonder, Ms. Baker Galloway, we should just pass over that, given that, again, if you're going to shift the goalposts, it's a little bit on the nose that you should then criticise the witnesses who have been left behind in the process.
Noted. Yes, noted. It possibly goes to the depth of inquiry, though, by the council's witnesses as to the actual difference in heights, because those houses are considered at 3.8 metres high, so that is the baseline, and the rule poses a 4 metre height limit, so it is only 0.2 metres that on the record could have been ascertained. But point taken. Furthermore, Dr. Reid has not assessed where such views are from, nor provided a visual assessment attached to evidence to support such a finding, nor established whether such a height crest would be visible at all. On the 8 main site specifically, as provided in Mr. Ferguson's evidence in chief, the location of the 8 additional home sites has been investigated further since council and environment court hearings to identify how these could be better integrated into the site and wider landscape without causing adverse effect. It is important to note that the 8 sites were never declined by the Environment Court, as they were not pursued at the appeal stage. Conversely, the Court reflected on the findings that the site was within a lower and comparatively small part of the landscape with different and somewhat lesser qualities of naturalness humane to the non-native vegetation which denoted the site. And in respect of the 42 houses, the proposal comes close to exceeding the threshold but may not if an appropriate set of conditions and covenants is imposed.
This is Bruce Galloway. You, Ferguson, and I think it was Bluger, have all quoted that paragraph. I wonder if you're taking rather too much out of it, in that I read that as suggesting that at 42, the court viewed you as close to the line, which does not suggest that there is huge scope to amend or to expand the number.
Well, I think that, with respect, is taking it is going further than the court could have gone, because there was no evidence before the court of that anything beyond 42 in any event. So it wouldn't be a very helpful exercise to go down that particular rabbit hole. The court wasn't assessing the merits of 8, but the opportunity was left available for an additional 8, very explicitly.
I think that what you're saying is that you can't take it either way.
That's right. Yes, that's right. Whereas some people have the perception that the 8, that there's some adverse finding in respect of the 8 at the court level, but there was not.
It is left in the implications that you draw from that single 3 lines.
Yeah.
Carol, please.
Thank you. A reflection that the 8 home sites were not pursued and that the threshold for development was not necessarily reached for 42 home sites is also seen in the consent conditions and in the consent notice wording, which are set out there. And at paragraph 43, I note that the residential activity area retains a framework for that assessment of the merits of the additional 8 sites to be carried out. Ms. Pfluger assessed the 8 additional home sites on site in detail, along with the detailed designs for the building platforms on each of these 8 home sites developed by the submitter, which include choice of appropriate RLs, earth mounding, specific planting, and retention of existing native vegetation to ensure that at most only very small parts of the buildings, less than the top metre, will be visible from any of the viewpoints along the road between Fernburn Bridge and the Glendhu Bluffs. Ms. Pfluger considers this level of visibility appropriate and in line with potential visibility of the other consented home sites. In her view, this detailed site analysis and micro-siting will ensure that inappropriate adverse effects over and above the effects of the consented development can be avoided. The introduction of an additional 8 home sites in the context of the overall development will not introduce a higher level of domestication in this part of the landscape, given that the mitigation measures in the form of planting were originally designed for the overall development for 50 residential sites.
Right. Tease out that point a little, like the way that, as I read the court's discussion of the extent of the mitigation, and this goes to a point that Dr. Roper Lindsay discussed with me last week. What the court, the way the court reasoned it, was it said the revegetation amounts to 1.5 hectares per house site. And Mr. Darby managed to convince the court that it shouldn't, by comparing that with other developments in the area, require more than 1.5 hectares per house site. But it does suggest that if you're going to add 8, you need 8 times 1.5 more revegetation.
But where we got to with Dr. Robert Lindsay was that no one could be clear on what proportion of the vegetation was the positive effect and what parts of it were for mitigating visual effects. And because that equation was never really, if it was undertaken, it was not recorded in the decision. So it's on the record, but Mr. Darby might be able to assist. It's a murky area exactly how much of the vegetation was positive effect vegetation and what part of the planting is literally visual screening and landscape mitigation.
Right. I suppose my point is that whatever the end result, if the court proceeded on the basis that the overall package was adequate on a function of house sites times 1.5, there must surely be an issue as to whether your revegetation proposal in the zone provisions, it was the minimum that Mr. Ferguson's now produced, and I have an issue I need to clarify with him as to whether that minimum in fact equates with what the court has done, but that's a different issue.
Yes, that's meant to reflect the revegetation strategy and the consent.
All right, they're calling it spade a spade, so he can think about it before he gives evidence. Yes. The court says there's 65 hectares of revegetation, and he's got a minimum of 20 odd.
Some of that's regeneration, I think, rather than actual planting.
Yeah, that might be right.
Yeah. But that's when we get to the bottom of it.
But there's a mismatch. There appears to be a mismatch.
Yeah.
So what Dr. Roper Lindsay said was there wasn't any mitigation required for ecological purposes.
Yes.
But she couldn't speak to the other reasons why you might provide additional revegetation or replanting.
Mm.
But my point is therefore that the judge was clearly had in mind all of the package of reasons where he might, and he was thinking about it, the court that he was speaking for was thinking about it in terms of a function of house sites times 1.5 hectares. So I'm left saying, you're telling me that because the mitigation measures were designed for 50, that's all right, but that doesn't appear to have been the reasoning of the court.
One of the parts where that's all right is if you look at when we get to Mr. Thompson's evidence, he appends the planting plans that were approved by the court, and the pods where the building platforms would be of the 8, you can still see them in the planting plan as pods. They're not proposed to be planted. So in that sense, that's one of the aspects that I'm talking about. The planting plan that is consented and in place and required now has 50 clear pods in it amongst the required plantings.
Well, I'm sure that's right.
That's one of the aspects of those trying to refer to.
But as I say, the court was looking at it, say, partly ecological mitigation, partly visual mitigation, partly positive benefits to take, in effect, to take the proposal over the top.
And then there's the fencing and the stock removal as well.
And the tracks and the whole package.
Yeah.
But at least as regards vegetation.
Mm.
And so, as I say, I should put it on the table for Mr. You and Mr. Ferguson to ponder. I think there's a mismatch in what the court said its reasoning is an argument for the putting to make.
Right. Well, I mean, and the other thing to look at will be the fact that there is the discretion, like as I said, we've tried to do the framework so that it achieves at least the same benefits and enhancements, but it is open, you know, there is discretion there for more when the proposal is assessed on its merits under the framework.
So, please, Carol.
Thank you. So, last sentence, the consented development will introduce a higher level of domestication within this contained part of the landscape and is currently found, and Ms. Pfluger considers that the additional 8 home sites will be in character with this development in terms of their location, siting and mitigation measures. Then on the topic of design of the 50 dwellings, in respect of Dr. Reed's conclusion that the variability of home site designs would result in a high-end housing suburb rather than the consistent character of a resort, I firstly note that there is no policy direction against providing for a high-end housing suburb, nor is there any evidence that the R activity area and associated controls would result in something out of character with a resort-type development. However, in response to those concerns for amenity, Mr. Ferguson has refined the provisions relating to buildings in the R activity area through the addition of a set of assessment matters designed to provide further guidance and factors relating to external appearance of the buildings and to preserve the built form coherence and amenity. In the supplements for all 44.5.2, including a wide-ranging list of controls council would have in consenting any building, including in particular the integration with revegetation and mitigation planting contained within the revegetation strategy provided for within Rule 4454. Ms. Pfluger supports those additional controls as they will allow for maintenance of an overall amenity of the development. And just like any of the provisions that Mr. Ferguson has drafted, should the Commission think that it's worth focusing on those for them to be refined to the point that the council witnesses and other submitters' witnesses are happy, you know, that's obviously anticipated. So they're not set in stone in that regard. On the golf area, the provisions in respect of the golf course continue to ensure that ecological revegetation and regeneration and public access benefits otherwise required by the consent. The proposed extension of the golf course area over to the Fernburn is addressed by Mr. Thompson in terms of golf course design, and to the extent that it does not involve built form in that area, will remain consistent with open space protection established under the underlying covenant. The large areas of covenanted open space within the OSF area are directly tied to development of the golf course, public amenities and the residential visitor accommodation units. And then finally, for the Glenview Station farm homestead and campground areas, the amended provisions as set out in Mr. Ferguson's supplementary evidence for the farm homestead area are intended to ensure that built development in FH remains consistent with the underlying covenant while enabling the diversification of economic activity complementary to the wider farming activities. So meaning the scale of built form is now proposed to be restricted so that it reflects that covenant prevented further development. But the small-scale commercial activities that are set out in the structure plan definition of FH are enabled through that restricted discretionary framework. And the provisions enabling establishment of an additional campground area are intended to further allow diversification in a manner consistent with and complementary to existing activities in the immediate vicinity. The FH and C areas in particular are proposed to enable the McRae family to continue to plan in the medium and long term for the station's viability. In conclusion, the proposed zone is intended to build upon the positive benefits secured by the consent, both in terms of the scale of appropriate development enabled, and also, and equally importantly, in terms of the protection and enhancement of important natural character, biodiversity, landscape and recreation values. The package as a whole is more than just protect the values as they currently exist. It is intended to ensure enhancement of those values and enablement of activities suited to the site in a way that is more appropriate than the rural zone is notified. For a site of this significance and scale, it is more appropriate in my submission to embed the changes provided for under the substantive consent into the district plan in a similar way to other special zones of a similar nature and scale. Because it's no longer pure rural land. It's very different because of the mere fact of the covenants, and it's very different because of the consent of development. So it's not just a farm anymore, and that's one of the reasons why a zone is a more appropriate planning mechanism to manage this land in the future. I don't propose to go through Appendix 1 because obviously that repeating myself more in my further supplementary submissions next week. But did you want to look at that Davidson a little bit, even though it's got leg to appeal now?
I'd just like to discuss Turners and Growers. I've got 2 points arising out of your discussion in your appendix, and I just want to explore with you.
Okay.
So thank you for referring me to that decision, which I can pass by, sitting in Wanaka for many weeks. I agree with interest the extensive quote that you included in paragraph 20. I also read the subsequent discussion of His Honour Justice Gilbert, but in effect it made no difference because the Environment Court was referring to part two and to the objectives and policies interchangeably because, of course, it had already decided what it thought were the objectives and policies that best gave effect to part two. And so the question for you is, are we in the same position? The objectives and policies that the various hearing panels recommend on the text of the plan will be those that, in their opinion, are the most appropriate to meet all the standard, all the Section 32 tests, including achieving, giving effect to your obligations in relation to Part 2, giving effect to the operative RPS, having particular regard to whatever the documents are we have particular regard to, and having regard to the other documents, so that's the test.
Mm.
And so, the in practice, resort back to Part 2 is only going to apply in a true exception, something, a left field type position that's not addressed by the objectives and policies. And we've had one suggestion already as to that might occur. Or where the panel's recommendations on the text are constrained by scope issues. Because in every other respect, the intention is that the recommended objectives and policies will give effect to Part 2, among other things.
Yes, but can I just explore something with you? My Section 32 isn't a test. It's a process that's required to be undertaken to ensure good planning. But so there's no, I think, requirement in the Act that subservient provisions in a plan give effect to superior provisions.
Section 74?
Yes, Section 74, but it doesn't say, I don't think it says give effect to it. Maybe I need to look at this over lunch. So, in Section 32, obviously, councils could do their analysis and show what they've done, but it's not a strict test that the giving effect to requirement.
Yeah, but. But the ultimate section, the question that's asked under Section 32 is in relation to objectives, is the objective the most appropriate
that's
way to
right.
Choose the purpose of the end?
Yes, that's right, most appropriate, which is different to give effect to.
Well, yes,
that's
but is it that different? It's like,
because you can give effect to the Act in many ways, and that's asking which is the most appropriate way to do it.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. 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 Perhaps
I can consider that. So in effect, I'm saying, with reference to paragraph 48 of Justice Gilbert's evidence, are we in the same position?
Okay.
And the only time in practice where Part 2 might make a difference is in a true exceptional case, or where the panel is constrained by scope.
Okay.
And have been unable to recommend what in its view is the most appropriate objective to give effect to the purpose of the Act.
Good, thank you. I'll make sure I address that.
And the other question, similar spot, page 21H, you said, last sentence, a method which not intended to encompass a proposed alternative zoning. If it's not a method, what is it?
The zone?
Yes.
Oh, well, it's a full suite of provisions from. It can't be just a method because it's objectives, policies, rules, and methods. A method is, I interpret method as being the regulatory and non-regulatory mechanisms by which council actions its policies.
Oh, so that's what you're referring to. Because
yes.
Because your rezone, your new zone, has its own objectives and policies.
And methods, yeah.
And, put it another way. It has objectives and policies, and the methods are, in fact, the structure plan,
yes.
The zone maps, the activity areas.
Yeah.
That's what you mean.
Yes.
Commissioners, any questions from Ms. Baker-Gilman?
No, I do would like to discuss with Mr. Ferguson that. Because I too was reading the Environment Court's ruling on the 1.5 hectares, and just to push that discussion, because you essentially are increasing by 20% the house lots, but not from whatever percentage was set aside for revegetation compensation was all balanced out. So we'll go through that in detail, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Nope, I have no.
Well, on that basis, what's your order of batting?
So, Mr. Darby first. Drop this all down. I'm not to expect Mr. Darby. And then I will actually call Mr. Gourmet next. So, I'm assuming he'll be quite brief, and then I'll let him go with the name of the panel.
I think you can, you don't need to ask me. I think you can take this as a given. That the only person we'd like to stay until the bitter end is Ms. Fleeter because of the potential for interaction between Mr. Ferguson's answers and her sphere of expertise. But everyone else, they want to do a runner after they've given evidence as well.
Very good. Thank you. And then after Mr. Gourmet, Mr. Thompson, Brett Thompson.
Yep.
And then Ms. Fleeter, that she will stay. And then hopefully Mr. Carr, but he's having plane issues, so I'll check. Oh, he's right back. He's here. That's good. So then Mr. Carr. And then Mr. Ferguson.
If you're not here, put your hand up.
Yeah.
Well, in that case, we have Mr. Darby.
Mr. Darby, thank you.
Land use management of a very unique high country
station within the Lakes District. Waverness and Chief explains in detail the background to the original proposal and how intrinsic to its development was the family focus of the McRae family and their vision for a diversified form of high country farming. This joint aspiration was at the heart of informing all of our objectives and design outcomes for the Parkins Bay proposal. And it's entirely appropriate that those aspirations and the commendable vision that the McRae family have become formalised in the district plan framework to enable longer term planning so that the legacy can grow and consolidate in order to even bring great benefits to the wider community. Intrinsic to the reasoning behind achieving a zoning outcome based upon the Parkins Bay proposal is the philosophy and purpose of the district rural zone, which I address in my evidence in chief under paragraphs 10 through 15. I consider the biggest travesty of the proposed district plan process in respect to the rural zone would be to arrive at an outcome where landowners, particularly farmers, are not encouraged and enabled to diversify historic farming practices to ensure the ongoing viability and versatility of their land. I do not consider that a zone provides for the status quo in terms of farming methods and ancillary activities only is forward-looking in a way which is necessary for this district to survive and protect its celebrated landscapes as well as provide for its people and the community. The vision that I support is that landowners like McRae's, who have innovative ideas for sustainable farming methods and other activities suitable for their farmland, are supported and encouraged to realise these outcomes. It seems contrary to the very purpose of protecting outstanding natural landscapes that landowners would not be enabled to seek an alternative source of income, say be it from visitor accommodation or recreation, which also achieves a better environmental outcome. For example, retiring high country land from grazing or vegetation restoration or providing enhanced public access and recreational opportunities. That balance is exactly what the Glendu Station Zone seeks to achieve and which fills a gap that I think currently exists in the rural zone. Significant time and expense has been invested to implement the consent to date. We continue, for example, to undertake significant site investigations as to the suitability of different areas for the construction of golf holes, which would have lesser environmental impact in terms of the volume of earthworks required, better utilise the natural landforms, and overall improve the environmental outcomes. However, some of these changes require variation of the consent. Commencing construction is imminent on the site, however, it is a considerable financial investment which relies on the enduring certainty of the consents granted in a zoning framework, as opposed to a myriad of complex and cross-referencing resource consents. Key outcomes for the Glendu Station Zone. The Glendu Station Zone addresses some ambiguous and complex provisions in the existing consent, particularly in relation to staging. Some of the conditions imposed have eventuated to be rather arbitrary in their application and in terms of managing effects on the environment. The Glendu Station Zone fully respects the existing consent, but provides a better framework going forward that can accommodate refinement and improvement to the original scheme first designed in 2004. The architecture, for example, has been updated rather than changed dramatically. In this respect, the zone will be a better way of managing effects of development going forward. The zone correctly reflects the current and long-term land use for this part of the Glendu Station. is no longer part of the active farm. It provides a better framework for delivering positive outcomes and minimising any adverse effects without the need of a protracted and prescribed consenting process. Other projects we've been involved in have been successfully implemented through a zoning process, which provides specific resource use outcomes and which reflects the use of that land already assessed as appropriate by the council and the Environment Court. This has proven to be a more efficient way to ensure protection, development and use of resources in an area are most appropriate and that the outcomes of development are consistent. An overarching policy and objective framework for the zone can ensure the original vision and philosophy for the use of the land is realised. This leaves less room for further or future ambiguity and interpretation in consents. In light of those objectives stated above, the following are the key outcomes which the Glenview Zone, the Glenview Station Zone seeks to achieve. Firstly, it provides a comprehensive planning framework for Glenview Station implementing the Parkins Bay development without creating adverse effects, with works well underway in accordance with the existing consents, including planting mitigation. We now have the benefit of hindsight as to what mitigation measures are actually achieving their intended purpose and what could even be done better. The proposed zone establishes a framework to enable variation of sequencing requirements while still in the long term achieving the same environmental benefits. The zone provides a refined overall structure plan that remains rooted in protecting and enhancing recreational, ecological, conservation and amenity values while providing for 8 of the original proposed residences without adverse effects through careful siting of home sites and integration with the landscape. It enables the McRae family to diversify their large land holding by providing for activities through a planning and consent framework that balances certainty, economics, landscape and environmental protection for generations to come. And in response to council's evidence, I note the rebuttal evidence of the council acknowledges the vision and the reasons provided in support of the Glencoe Station Zone proposal. However, I am concerned that this is not backed up by a more thorough analysis of how the Glencoe Station Zone will achieve the best management of resources, given the development already occurring in the area and the positive benefits offered, particularly those compared to the rural zone. I think the comments made by the Environment Court in the interim and final decisions are important to remember in this context.
I think you can take
that. I can take that as read. I think about to suggest that, Mr. Chairman. Those extracts provide what I consider to be some of the most important findings of the Parkins Bay decisions, and which reflect the very detailed, considered in advance design, which was ultimately considered by the court to achieve sustainable management of the land resource. The Glenview Station Zone has carefully crafted its provisions to replicate those particular design elements and positive benefits and enhance those where possible. The zone overall seeks to achieve a combined land use management and development package which is also economically sustainable, particularly through careful planning and design of built elements, identified activity areas, open space, landscape protection, as well as ecological, recreational, public access enhancement. The design controls for home sites to be imposed, all buildings, including home sites, will be subject to design control, as we have done in the case of other developments. This will be reflected in the provisions of the zone by way of standards specific to sites, covering building form, materials, and addressing potential adverse effects such as reflectivity. This would be supplemented by complementary privately imposed design controls as well. It's typical of all our projects. This will also result in building form consistent with that already approved by the Environment Court in terms of, for example, scale of built form. The objective is the resulting buildings would have no greater environmental effect than those already approved by the Environment Court. Bulk location, form and materials are consistent with the original design approved, and these reflect the character of the landscape setting. It is intended that a management regime for the home sites will be implemented so that the R residential activity area is managed comprehensively and will remain an integrated and high amenity resort community that provides for visitors, residents and locals all being able to utilise and take benefit. Overall, these design controls will go well beyond what is provided for in the rural zone, which by its nature is also in sensitive landscapes. Refinement of the zone, I consider that the historical entitlement of the consent should be reflected in the proposed district plan. We've always intended and hoped that in the future the proposed district plan or a private plan change would be pursued to ultimately reflect the consent and reflect the certainty of the zone and the planning framework. The consent is an enduring land use, as reflected in the covenants, which are enduring for terms of between 20 and 35 years. In reality, a consenting framework with a limited term is not appropriate to reflect that long-term intention. Land that is being predominantly farmed may well be best served under the rural zone. However, land that is that has diversified use, such as what we have proposed at Parkins, would be better served by objectives and policies to recognise that. The McRae family's tenure review took longer than expected, after which time the resource consent was progressed. It has been a very protracted process which took years to ultimately traverse. We assisted the McRae's during this period and understood their objectives regarding succession and diversification of the stations. We continue to work alongside the McRae family to realise their original vision and outcome for the future of the new station. This is a project I personally near and dear to my heart and will remain active and committed to, subject to the certainty being reflected in the district plan. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please, David. Just want to bounce off in your summary statement. As you say, you're a very experienced developer. You run large projects for similar, but obviously not identical, types of developments. You obviously understood the difference of what you were getting with a resource consent process over a private plan change when you kicked off the process in the late 2000s.
Yes, I recall council at that stage were not supportive, and in fact if you go back and look at that period in time there were very few private plan changes, and there was a period there was in fact a technical reason why a private plan change couldn't be advanced, whether some matters had been dealt with within the 2 year window, I believe. In fact, I nearly edited my own summary then, Mr. Chairman, to say that the private plan change was not an option at the time. And I can't be specific as to the reasons. I believe the land may have been subject to, might have been to do with the outstanding natural landscape case running, or there was some reason. And we accepted that we could initiate this project with resource consent. We did that with Millbrook, and council then agreed to having approved the development as a resource consent, that it then be incorporated into what was now the operative district plan,
back then, that was in 1992, so we're now in the proposed district plan, a review of that, and this process we followed for Millbrook and many other projects is very much where a resource consent may initiate. It was entirely supported by the community. There was only two objectors, and we were actually quite disappointed the council had not inquired into this matter to include in the proposed district plan. I believe it's an oversight. They have the benefit of enduring covenants for 25 to 35 years that a significant public benefit, public access, revegetation, retirement from grazing, and yet didn't address it.
So Mr. Darwin, we only have one day for the entire...
So the private plan change, I believe, there was technical reasons, and we've always sought to have it addressed, and the proposed district plan is the exact process under which that should occur.
You've emphasised the certainty of zone provision. It seems to me that the resource consent that you've got is entirely certain, has no term. The trouble you have... Once commenced, it has no term. And there, as I discussed with Ms. Baker Galloway, there's probably a good argument that you've already got over that trigger. It seems to me that the trouble you have is that it's too certain that the zone provisions aren't providing certainty, they're providing flexibility. Is that fair?
No, I believe the flexibility is around the process under which you can progress development. We've already had to file five resource consents, I believe, and we've been in projects before. We're constantly filing the resource consents, and the real danger here is the officers dealing with those consents have no context or not even a history at times. Yes, diligent ones might go back to the hearing records and read the court's decision, but more often than not, there is no reference or consistency. So the resource consent, while its timeline might be not such a critical issue, the ability for the land use to change is in fact greater if it's not under the provisions of a specific zone. The consents we could choose, or landowners could choose not to give effect to the consents and seek an entirely different use. That would be somewhat more difficult under a specific zone as opposed to a rural general zone, for example. And the McRae vision, and one that I fully support, is to ensure the development that has been talked about is just that, no more. It delivers exactly what we've said. And how do we manage this over the many years it takes to build these and evolve them? I believe the resource consent process is inferior to a zone that clearly has objectives. So in all cases, all our projects, while they may commence with resource consents, we see them being specific to land. If there is a zone that is appropriate, great, but the rural general zone in this district is not one that I believe is the right overlay of what is a very significant large area of land.
And Mr. Darby, I want to talk about staging. That's, as I perceive it, a key issue for you with the existing the constraints created by staging.
Yes, and there's some history to that, Mr. Chairman. I might be able to expand on that.
Well, could I just put the question to you, so you provide the content.
I'll make the question.
My question relates to the
court decision that said that you that accepted your evidence that staging was both necessary and addressed a relevant adverse effect that was being pursued by Mr. Howard for the Clerk Environmental Society, namely the time that the vegetation would take to grow. So on the basis that you profited, the court accepted it. Rhetorical question I asked Dr. Roper Lindsay, she couldn't answer the question. What's changed?
Yes, I can be very specific on that point. We're not seeking to change the order of events that relate to critical matters of, for example, revegetation being mitigation for possible visibility of buildings. We're not seeking and never have. The staging plan that the court requested we assist them with had many other staging elements beyond those matters the court were interested in, or Mr. Howells had raised, that were not material in any way to the concern of the court or the effects that might arise. The order in which we build golf holes, the sequencing of one road versus another road, the whole raft, the staging plan that was submitted was for complete information for the benefit of the court and went well beyond the staging of those critical issues, which would be the mitigation and revegetation works. And we're not seeking in any way to make life easier or in any way conflict what I've said right consistently through all the hearings. It just inadvertently, a huge amount of documents were supplied to the court by way of assistance. The staging plan went well beyond to include infrastructure issues and subsurface servicing that has no material effect or should be the subject of backwatering. So to the extent of flexibility, we are not referring to the flexibility to escape or diminish any of the mitigation or critical benefits that are really cornerstones of the court's decision.
In that case, later in your evidence, you emphasise the integrated nature of the whole operation and effectively that the residential houses are what makes the economics of the golf course work. That's my paraphrase.
Yep, that's.
And paragraph 26. And you said one cannot exist without the other.
Is that the evidence in chief?
Yes, paragraph 26. And the proposition I want to put to you was that the court disagreed with that and said, yes, agreed that the golf course can't go ahead without the residences, but disagreed that it couldn't be the other way. You could build the residences without the golf course.
Yes, and it wasn't just the golf course, Mr. Chairman. It was also the retirement of considerable acreage from active farming and its restoration into native cover and the provision of public walkways through it, all of great cost. So, yes, you could just have housing. I conceded that point. Of course, that's what everyone seeks in this area, isn't it? Just to create residential or economic outcome through subdivision housing. Yes, that's most viable on its own, and very viable, of course, without all the mitigation and environmental benefits. But that was totally in conflict with the McRae vision. They could have done that many years ago, a lot easier, like many other farmers in the surrounding area that subdivided their farms into 50 acre lots or 10 acre lots. So the McRae vision was about delivering a balanced land use outcome that included golf. Yes, I would agree, the term neither could exist without the other. Well, housing on its own could, but it would be in conflict with the McRae vision, which we abound into in what we do. So we would not be free ourselves, nor would we be interested in doing it. Probably be a lot more economic, I'm sure, Mr. Chairman. We didn't have to add to the whole suite of benefits and improvements that this package is. So I guess I was referring to the fact I was bound into McRae and support the McRae vision and fully support it.
And I think that the proposition that where I'm coming from is that I understand that you're in the business of constructing integrated golf course resorts, but I also have to be concerned that you should lose control of the project for whatever reason. If the McRae's, who have their own vision that's allied, should likewise lose control, whether the provisions that are suggested still have the constraints that ensure that the key elements that are tied together currently through the resource consents all come to pass. So the concrete example is that one of the effects of the staging requirements and the conditions is that you can't you can only proceed with the first 10 houses in conjunction with the golf course, and those houses can't be occupied until the golf course is completed. Are you comfortable that the zone provisions still require that linkage? And to the extent that they don't, would you wish that they were amended, whatever is required to ensure they do?
Probably personally, yes, Mr. Chairman, on that matter. But as I understood it, there was some debate even from, there was only two opponents, as to whether there should even be a golf course. They were in support of the retirement of the land from grazing and its restoration into native colour and public walkways. And I stand to be corrected, and in fact Mr. Ferguson will be able to talk more in detail around the proposed zone provisions, is the linkage. Certainly the mitigation revegetation is an essential element of any progression of housing, and I believe the Environment Court made that strong linkage. I'm uncertain whether it extended to construction of the golf in the discussion and matters that the court, and it was a very detailed hearing, gave consideration to. As opposed, it was on the staging plan we submitted to assist the court, that in turn also defined all the stages.
So your answer is, as I read it, that may not have been a critical element.
No,
it was in the court's mind.
In fact, the opposition or the opponents to the proposal were arguing even against golf as a land use. But golf courses are a permitted activity, so I guess there was not a lot of debate. Earthworks, different of course. But the court never, I believe, interrogated the issue of golf. It was not seen as mitigation, it was seen as public benefit. And Wanaka is short of golf courses, it's only has one and it's at full capacity. So there would have been reference to the benefit to the community from having a recreational asset like a golf course. But in terms of the effects, the environmental effects.
I believe it was not a matter considered by the court as being in any way mitigation or argument for it. But I will again stand, my memory is not bad but not brilliant, but that would be my understanding. The staging of the golf holes happened to be on our staging development plan. That was not a plan prepared for the court to reflect conditions that became adopted. And this typically happens when in an environment court, and I certainly respect of Judge Jackson, but he it was 2 years for the decision to come out, and there was a reconvene to go through material. And I believe at that time we should have corrected the staging plans of the matters he particularly wished to identify.
So your point is that it may just have been a byproduct out, and at this range we can only speculate. If he didn't write that down as part of his reasons, then it's there's no basis to know either way.
Yes, but in terms of what our intent is and what we are doing, it does involve golf. So to that extent, Mr. Chairman, I agree. As to the reasons why under the Resource Management Act, the proposed district plan and all the other matters that the Environment Court had regard to, I don't see it as being necessary mitigation and refinement for the housing, for example.
Commissioner Hudson, any questions? Commissioner McLeod, any questions for Mr. Bell?
There's only one golf course in Wanaka. Are you marginalising Tarras and Hawea?
Oh, sorry. I should have qualified it by saying 18 holes.
Yeah. And just, this, a recurring theme through all of the evidence is, and you use it yourself in your evidence in chief when you say that a minor increase, 8 units are a minor increase. And it's, if you say something often enough, it almost becomes, I mean, the Americans have just elected a president on stuff that was said often enough that people believed it. That's a 20% increase in the housing stock. And I don't think that that's necessarily, in my mind, a minor increase. Have I got that wrong?
The effects arising from those 8 residences, most certainly, and you'll hear more detailed evidence in respect to this, are minor. In terms of the abstract, a 20% increase, and we were representing that as de minimis or a matter of little concern. It's well addressed in evidence. It's been the subject of careful study to ensure that those 8 met the rigorous test that we otherwise imposed on 42. And the history was we sought 50. The council decision were uncertain about 8 of the sites. The decision was issued. We chose not to appeal that decision for many reasons other than the 8 residences. So we went into the Environment Court with the 42. The court, in the spirit of actually, you know, open disclosure and honesty with the hearing itself, we raised the additional 8. It was beyond the scope of the court. It was not a matter that we had appealed. But we wished to do that in a way that we would not be accused of coming back later seeking 8. So we disclosed it to the court, explained how we would, our decision not to appeal was we would make further progress and seek those at a later date, including a lodge site, and gave full physical description and intent to the court. And the court even commented it was neutral. They in fact at one point saw that there was scope to accommodate a further 8,
And I believe that you'll hear evidence as to how that can be achieved with minor effects. It is a necessary part to complete the development, one that I always believe we put on merit. We hope we don't have to head to the Environment Court again to win that argument. But if so, so be it. And I would hope the evidence you hear today will satisfy you that the reference to it being minor, it's in respect to effects. Additional revegetation works result, and overall it fulfills the original vision of the McRae family, who, and it is important to point out, in entering into this arrangement for developing their land, have a binding covenant on it that says there will never be more than 60 homes ever. Our studies identified 50 as opposed to 60. So that is a binding arrangement enduring on the land by way of covenant and set by the McRae family to ensure this doesn't become Millbrook, for example, where we originally set that at 250, but it's heading to double that number through creek. So we're quite concerned that these things don't end up something we didn't intend them to be, and we support that.
And one further point, I'm not sure if it's actually you that needs to address this, but maybe for general discussion, is that the, you mentioned it a few times, and other people have, that the McRae station is not realistically to rely solely on primary production for existence. And I hope there's going to be some evidence that's presented, because if you can't make a 3,000 hectare station productive in terms of primary production, it would help us all.
Yes, and if I could respond to that, Commissioner, is that the economics of Glendu Station, and in the early history, of course, Glendu is a very popular public recreation visit, you know, for visitors, active lake activities, etc. And originally the Glendu Bay camping ground was gifted by Glendu Station, and the public have continued to use walkway or walking routes over the station, and the McRae family have always been very supportive of public access, at times to their detriment, I believe, in terms of attitude of people, but they've embraced it. They were faced with a generational change where the parents who had the farm had three children, one son and two daughters. So the reference to economics and sustainability in farming were around diversifying rather than simply selling the farm. And the daughters' interest in tourism activities, hosting of weddings, functions, and indeed opportunities that might arise from new land use associated with tourism. So leaving a viable farm for one of the children generationally, and he is pursuing organics, which has led to this very proposal today to incorporate farm produce, which we believe is of great benefit to the tourism industry and visitors, and the expansion of the camping ground. So it's where you move from, you maintain the traditional farming methods. And it is interesting that high country farming requires massive acreage to work, but it also produces the landscape we value, that is the more native grassland swards, as opposed to shelter belts and improved pastures and irrigation, or dare I say dairy farms. So I think the McRae family being to be commended in their vision and the stewardship of the land, because it's entirely possible to intensify or undertake activities that improve the economics of the farm that are very adverse to the valued landscape character. So that's really what drove this. the economic viability of what's left is viable when it's part of an integrated visitor, local visitor economy, and augmented by activities such as weddings, etc. So that's how you provide for the next generation without simply subdividing it up or selling it off, like many farmers do. And they would have made considerably more on the economics if they had pursued that. And that's really when they approached us in 2003 to share thoughts and ideas how they could provide for the next generation and protect the valued character of this really important farm.
Very good. It's also lunchtime.
Yes.
We'll be back at 2.
Thank you.
So we'll finish with Mr. Darby and move on to Mr.
Gumay.
Gumay.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much.